We're beginning our discussion of frequently asked question number 15, is the resurrection real? And I believe if you didn't get a handout, there are some in the back, you won't need it today. I don't think that we're going to get to the questions today. A lot of times we do, but there are so many verses that are found in the article, and I want to spend some time discussing those things that we're going to probably spend the majority of our time this evening discussing the actual article or some thoughts that would arise from that, and then maybe get started on the discussion questions next week. I mentioned already, at least Sunday, we made note of it, that I'm going to be out of town next Wednesday. I'm going to be in Temple, Texas at a congregation, Leon Valley congregation, preaching a meeting. And Brother Roger Paulsell will be teaching the class in my place next week. So he'll take over where we leave off, depending on how far we get, next Wednesday evening. But we're going to be discussing again the question, is the resurrection real? And there are a couple of things to make note of. You'll be, when you're presented with this question, you'll be talking to an individual who is perhaps skeptical. Most religious people will accept the fact of the resurrection, those who are believers in Christ. But not everyone is a believer in Christ. Other religions, those who are atheists, agnostics, those who are modernists, individuals who have a naturalist's view of all things, will deny the resurrection of Jesus Christ, because after all, what we are claiming when we claim that Jesus was raised from the dead is that someone came back to life from the dead. And when we think about those things today, we dismiss pretty much out of hand that those things happen today. One of the big memes of our society is the idea of zombies, and there are a lot of fiction concerning zombies coming back from the grave and wreaking havoc, and we recognize that's fiction, horror, science fiction. There's no reality to that. We think nothing like that could ever happen, and we dismiss that out of hand. There are an awful lot of individuals who will say the same thing with regard to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It does not matter what evidence you might supply. It doesn't matter what eyewitness testimony you may make an allusion to from the past. It's not going to satisfy them. It's not going to convince them, because they have what we might refer to as a naturalist view of things. They deny out of hand the concept of the supernatural, so they're going to deny that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. So the most that they will accept is that Jesus was a rabbi, that he was an individual that lived at that time, who was a teacher, who had a philosophy, and maybe it was a good one. Maybe it was one that elevated the morals and ethics of man. Maybe his influence was substantial. But all he was a man. When he died, he remained in the grave. And you're not going to be able to convince them otherwise. So we need to just acknowledge that and recognize, when we've been talking about the fact that we accept things by faith, that this is one of those things that we do accept by faith, that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. But by its nature, that's a supernatural, rather than a natural view of things, it is a supernatural view of things. That we acknowledge that there is a God, and if there is a God, that He has the ability to do this, if it is His will. And then as we discuss God's Word, we determine from that indeed it was God's will, it was His scheme or plan for man, that Jesus Christ be raised from the dead. And it is upon that that our faith rests and our hope rests. The resurrection of Jesus Christ. It is fundamental. It is something that must be accepted in order to be truly a Christian. And so it is something that we accept. Now, having said that, I would deny that we accept it irrationally. Individuals will claim that it is an irrational thing. It's something that flies in the face of reason. And while it flies in the face of what man can indeed accomplish, There are a number of evidences that we can supply, which I think would open the hearts of those who would, at the very least, entertain the idea that there is a God, that indeed the resurrection could have happened, and in fact it did happen. And you get an individual who's unwilling to accept the reality of God. We've already talked quite a bit about the heavens declaring the glory of God, the firmament showing His handiwork, that is the best explanation for us, for the creation, for our existence. But if you have individuals who simply will not accept that, they deny the supernatural out of hand, you're not going to be able to convince them concerning the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The reasoning has to backtrack from that to discussions concerning the existence of God, and there has to be some acknowledgement of the possibility of that before we can get to the concept of the resurrection. So you'll have perhaps differing measures of success in convincing an individual depending upon where he is and his viewpoint or his way of looking at life might be at any particular time. Now, having said that, if we were to, and this isn't covered in the text, which is why I wanted to kind of touch upon it, if we were to discuss the evidences concerning the resurrection, what proof that we have concerning the resurrection, what we have to go to is, in fact, eyewitness testimony. The fact that there are individuals who lived at that time who saw the resurrected Christ. And that is the basis of our argument that we make, the case that we seek to erect concerning His resurrection. And it is a valid one, but again, recognize that there are individuals who will deny it. One of the things to kind of note, and I don't say this in any way to diminish or to demean the testimony, because I think it's very strong, but there are individuals today who will claim the same thing. I remember, and I don't know, maybe an apocryphal story. It may not be exactly true, but I was told that Leon Odom, who was a gospel preacher that out in West Texas where I grew up and then later moved to the Tyler area, and preached there for a while. He's since passed away this life. But he went with a friend of his to a Pentecostal service and had a hat pin in his hand, and the Pentecostals had advertised they were going to raise someone from the dead that evening. And I've been told that Leon raised him from the dead before the Pentecostal preacher did. I don't know if that's the case, but that's what I heard. They were parading alongside the body, and then he was going to raise him, and he stuck a pin in him and elicited a response prior to the resurrection. But there are a lot of credulous people. And again, I want you to understand that when we lay claim to the fact of Jesus' resurrection, there are going to be individuals who will claim we are likewise credulous. We are believing the unbelievable. And so you're, again, going to run into some individuals who will have a closed mind with regard to this. There are two types of eyewitnesses that we find in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 15 states all of those who saw the resurrected Jesus. You have those who were His followers. And because they were the followers of Jesus Christ, there are going to be individuals who will say they're false witnesses, and that their testimony cannot be trusted merely because they had a vested interest in perpetuating the myth of Jesus. They were aware of His prophecies concerning the fact, we read one just recently, that He said that He would raise the temple of His body up in 3 days, and so they had faith in that. And so what they were merely doing is they stole the body away of perpetuating the myth of Jesus' resurrection. And there are certain things that we can claim, that we can look to, as found in the biblical record itself, which would dissuade an individual from accepting that. Number one, the attitudes that the disciples had after His resurrection, as explained in Scripture. That they were individuals who were in despair at the death of Jesus. That they had determined to go back to their former way of life in that Jesus had died, and it wasn't until the resurrection that they regained that faith, indicating a couple of things. Number one, their despair, the human despair they had, but also that they perhaps did not have a full understanding of what Jesus had prophesied concerning himself until they saw the evidence of it in the resurrection. You'll remember that Thomas, who was not present with the other disciples the first time that they saw Jesus, in fact, doubted until such time as he could insert his finger in the holes where the nails had gone in and put his fist in the side of his Lord before he would believe. And so there was some disbelief that was present, or skepticism that was present among the disciples after his death on the cross. And we can make an allusion to that. Another thing that we can refer to with regard to their eyewitness testimony is that none of them recanted that testimony, even at the point of death. That these individuals had determined, you say, well, you know, what is their motivation to perpetuate this myth? Well, you know, they were followers of Jesus. Perhaps they loved him, but at the same time, if he had not been raised from the dead, he had shown himself to be a liar, a deceiver concerning the promises that he had made to them, his disciples, that he was going to build a mansion for them, and he would return as he had left. So there would be, you would think, some who would perhaps become disenchanted with the false claims that the Messiah had made and recant their testimony in regard to those things, or refuse to acknowledge his resurrection from the dead. But individuals, even at the point of the sword and execution, nevertheless maintained their faith and willingly gave up their life in the hope of a life to come. And as the Apostle Paul acknowledged, 1 Corinthians 15, that hope for the life to come was based solely in Christ's resurrection from the dead. If Christ had not been raised, and there is no resurrection, if there is no resurrection, then our faith is futile. We're still in our sins. So there are some things that we can turn to with regard to even those who were his followers and those who had a vested interest in the truthfulness or the veracity of that claim of the resurrection, to say that, you know, these are indications that indeed they saw the resurrected Lord. But we would also emphasize, and usually if I'm talking to an individual about that, I would make an appeal to Saul of Tarsus. And I do think that the reason why, or one of the reasons why Saul was chosen, who was chosen by Jesus as being an appointed vessel, an ambassador, an eyewitness, was because of who he was as the chief persecutor of the way. If you were to look to a single individual to be a hostile witness for the case concerning the resurrection, any individual who is more antagonistic toward the Christian faith and the claims of resurrection that lived upon the face of the earth at that time, Saul would be the one that would be chosen. He was chief among the Jews and persecuting those of the way. He was an individual who was dedicated to it. He was given over to it. He was accepted and entrusted by the religious leaders of the day in his effort to destroy the Christian faith. He was the foremost antagonist to Jesus Christ. And instantly... on an occasion that's recorded in Acts chapter 9, everything changed with regard to Saul. So the foremost enemy of the cross became the most strong eyewitness as to the fact of the resurrection. And serves as a tremendous, tremendous testimony for us today that Jesus Christ indeed was raised from the dead. And so if you develop that argument and you allow people to understand, recognize who Saul was, what his work was prior to the day that he met the Lord on the road to Damascus, and they're fully aware of that, then what you have is what is in fact an unimpeachable witness. You cannot successfully argue that his motivation was anything other than pure and sincere as he changed his testimony. Just no way to do that, to dispute that. And so now you have an individual who's basically an unimpeachable witness who says, stands up and says, I saw the resurrected Christ. And you're saying, I don't believe it. Now I want you to consider that in court of law. To where you weren't there, you know, you came about afterwards, weren't an eyewitness to what happened. And someone, let's say, who was on the opposite side of whatever the circumstance or situation was. Let's say there's a car accident. And you have someone who's in the car. They're the family of the person who's responsible for the accident. And they stand up and say, well, I hate to say it, but it was my brother or my mother or my father's fault. Yes, they're the ones that are responsible for the accident. And you come along afterward and say, I don't believe them. I believe they're lying. It doesn't make a lot of sense. There's no reason for that individual to lie. The only reason that he would say what it is that he's saying is because he has integrity. He's going to relate the truth because he's an honest person, even if that truth doesn't jive with what he desires or what he wants to be the case. And it doesn't make a lot of sense for someone who wasn't there to come by afterward and say that what that person is saying, this person of integrity, this person who is in fact a hostile witness, that what they are attesting to is not so, when the testimony that they gave directly contradicts what they themselves would have desired for it to be. And so what Saul of Tarsus becomes is an unimpeachable witness. And so if you're going to talk with someone, try to reason with them concerning the truth of the resurrection, I think about the strongest thing that you can do is to go to Acts chapter 9, Acts chapter 8, Acts chapter 9, well, Acts chapter 7, 8, 9, and develop who Saul of Tarsus was, explain who Saul of Tarsus was, show what happened on that occasion, and then make references not only to his testimony, because he makes that statement in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 8, last of all he appeared to me as one born out of due time, and also note how he counted all things that he had accomplished as a Jew, as refuse that he may win Christ. Completely changed his life. Suffered dire persecution. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and just read the list of all the things that Paul suffered. Here was an educated Jew, a Roman citizen. He was at the top of all things. You know, he was just he had it made in reputation and position as a Jew. And basically threw it all away to become a persecuted preacher, itinerant preacher. And the only reason why he would do such a thing is because he saw the Christ. And he becomes a very strong and, I believe, an impeachable witness as to the truth of the resurrection. If you accept the fact that there is a God and that the supernatural is possible, then you have an unimpeachable witness that says the supernatural is not only possible, but it actually did happen. And Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And all the claims that have been made are indeed true. Now, the interesting thing about this is that when you look at this this question, is the resurrection real? Again, at least in the article, basically the article says it better be. Because if it's not, we've got problems, because the entirety of our faith and the scheme of redemption and all that Jesus is to us is dependent upon the resurrection. And so we're going to spend some time emphasizing that. But I did want to just, for a few moments, touch upon the eyewitness testimony that we have, that we can have confidence in with regard to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we'll have opportunity as well when we get into the questions to discuss it in more detail. Yes, Kyle?
I just had one comment, and I'll use the words from a very famous man, Jesus himself, upon the viewpoint of non-believers. And it is John chapter 4, 48 is the verse, and it reads, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why the signs and wonders were supplied. And that has proven and shown that Jesus is who he claimed to be. The problem is that people who today are not willing to accept the fact that the signs and wonders were supplied, they want to see it for themselves today as well. There are many who make that claim. Yes.
I've never read Josephus, but I've read secular history saying some of the people, the other writers of the resurrection.
Yeah, Josephus makes reference to it. I don't have the citation. I don't remember well enough to quote it, but it's interesting that as a Jewish historian, as he makes reference to in one particular location, when he makes reference to the resurrected Christ, he doesn't reference it as a claim made by the disciples, but that it is an actual event that happened, which is kind of interesting that he would take that. Now, remember that the common story that was told, and again, I've used this to argue as to the veracity of the resurrection, because the other explanations that are given really don't hold water. You have a common story that was spread among the Jews that while the Roman guard slept, that the disciples of Jesus came and stole the body away, which again doesn't make any sense. Number one, because a Roman guard wouldn't sleep. Roman guards slept upon pain of death. Number two, the Roman guards were not punished for falling asleep. So that's an indication that it actually didn't happen. There are individuals who today, 2,000 years later, claim that Jesus was only in a swoon. That's problematic. Number one, as we consider what crucifixion was, not only with regard to the stripes that were laid upon him prior to his hanging upon the tree, but also the fact that he was stabbed in the side, as well as the exposure and the fact that there was an individual who was trained to determine whether someone was alive or a dead, who made the determination that he had indeed expired, that he had died. You come 2,000 years later and say, well, you know, the Roman centurion who looked at him to see whether he was dead was wrong, and he really only was in a swoon, and that he came to on his own later and managed somehow to roll the stone aside and to steal away without being seen. Again, the absurdity of those kinds of arguments are simply a way of explaining away the supernatural. I don't believe in the concept of resurrection. I don't believe that it's possible for someone who is dead to come back to life. I don't believe that can happen. Why? Because I don't believe in God. Because if I believe in God, it certainly can happen. If I believe in God, anything can happen. If I believe in God, then I accept that this entire universe exists because of Him. If I believe in God, then I accept that He has the power and the wisdom and the wherewithal to accomplish anything He desires, which means that the resurrection is not something that would be surprising if it's His will, if it's what He desires. So all these individuals, what they're doing is they come, understand this, they come from that preconception. It's not a normal event. It's not a natural event. Resurrection from the dead is not something that happens unless God determines to set aside the laws of nature and to perform a miracle, which is what He did in the case of His Son. He raised Him from the dead. If I don't believe in God, I'm not going to believe in the resurrection. And there are an awful lot of people out there who would deny that, is that for that very reason. But we accept that it's the case, and we accept it by faith. We have evidence that there is a God, and if we accept that there is a God, then we can accept the plausibility, if He so desires, that the resurrection could be fact. And then we have testimony that says it is. So it's a very reasonable and rational case and argument that we raise. But it's one that's not going to get off the ground to the individual who denies that God exists. And that's just a fact. Yes, Sean?
And then on top of that, didn't they wrap the bodies in linens and all that stuff? So it'd be almost impossible for him to be basically mummified to unwrap the bones.
Yeah.
It's, well, that's just being part of the temple. He wouldn't wrap the same way.
Yeah. Well, the wrapping, and I don't know. What I'm aware of with regard to the wrapping is that that there is a linen shroud. Now the Egyptians mummified, sure. There was basically a wrapping of a linen shroud front and back. So you basically lay on it and flipped over on the front, wrapped, folded in, and wrapped with a leftover sash, if you will. Now, as far as how tightly bound, I don't know.
But wrapped tight and has spices in there. I guess
Yeah, the tight wrapping or whatever, I don't know. And as far as how Lazarus was loosed from his bedclothes, I don't know that either, other than the fact that Jesus called him forth and he came forth. Thanks. All right. Okay, good. All right, let's continue on then. And let's look at some of the arguments that is made or that are made here in the article. It starts off in the first paragraph by saying that we live in a world that has deified science to the point that even certain hypotheses cannot be questioned without a charge of heresy being leveled. You'll notice that he puts science in kind of a religious realm here, talking about heresy. It's actually heresy to indicate or to claim that supernatural events can happen, or that there is any source for the supernatural. That's something that is a violation of science in the minds of many. That's an amazing thing to me, because it's almost an illogical thing. And I understand that what you have. Let's say we take the position that God created the universe. He created the universe with natural laws, and what we find and we understand is that the natural laws govern the processes and actions and reactions of both inanimate and animate objects and our lives and all these kinds of things. This is the natural universe. But it is made by a supernatural God. And it's His wisdom that has allowed the world to act, and the universe to act in the ways that it does, and to consist and subsist as it does. So, you know, we acknowledge that if you go into science and this is hard science, observable science, and you look at the various laws, that things go in accord with law. So you have the law of gravity. You have various laws of thermodynamics and all these various things that govern the physical universe. And we understand and recognize this. That's the way God made it. And we have no problem with that, no qualms with those laws as they exist. But what you have to do if you're going to be an individual who deifies science is get rid of the supernatural origin of these kinds of things, and to say that the physical laws don't work unless God's not in the picture. And that's simply not so. God can be in the picture, and the earth and the universe and life and all be as it is, if God authored it, if God made it that way. God can be in the picture. The scientists, these atheistic scientists, these naturalists, they say, in order for science to be science, you can't have God. They have, in effect, made science the God, rather than Jehovah. And that's a presupposition that they have that governs everything they do, every decision that they make. And so for you to come along and say, yes, isn't the physical universe wonderful? Look at how it all works together. Isn't it a wonderful thing that God made it that way? Well, you're being a heretic to say God made it that way. Because if you say God made it that way, you're not being scientific. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's not scientific. And that's the mistake, because it is scientific if it's true. You know, you say, well, you can't teach God in the science books and in the classrooms and in public education because that's religion. Well, yeah, but if God actually did it, it's also true. So what you're saying is we can't teach what's true. What we have to teach is something that's a lie, that's not true. The question is this true? Is it true or not? And to make the presupposition that it's not is illogical. You seek to determine those things, but there's nothing that is found in the physical science with the laws and the universe as it exists that precludes the possibility of God's existence. It is simply an assertion that men make that God's not there. And so we need to recognize that is what it is. And so these individuals who will deny what we're talking about, the existence of miracles, the existence of God, the concept of the resurrection, what they have done is basically arbitrarily said these things are heretical because they look outside of the physical universe for explanations, and that cannot be done. But again, you know, it's basically saying you can't do it, when in reality God is there. it's just a supposition that they make. I'm not making it as clear as I would like to, but it's a presupposition that they have. It's a claim that they make that is not provable in any way. The only way that you can prove that there is no God is if you can be everywhere at the same time and not seen. You understand what I'm saying? And we can't do that. Because we're living here on this earth, which is a very small place in the midst of an immense universe, and we're living at this particular time. And we are limited in the time-space continuum to being here now. And so just because we don't see God here now, that does not mean that He's not elsewhere at other times. And there's no way to disprove that possibility. So just keep that in mind, that these individuals who just say, heretic, if you even make any contention of the supernatural, are individuals who have that presupposition. And it is something that they claim by faith, and they don't have any more evidence to support that than what they claim we have when we contend that God does indeed exist. All right, so when we talk about the issue of the resurrection, then, as we alluded to earlier, modernists are not going to accept it because of such presuppositions. Skeptics are not going to, because they deny the supernatural. So when we say, and this is the second paragraph, that the resurrection of Jesus Christ after His death, and in following the eventual resurrection of all mankind, is a central tenet of Christianity, and you can't be a Christian without believing it. So it's something that we need to grapple with and come to an understanding about, because your faith is dependent upon it. They're not going to accept it, but there are individuals who will accept the concept of God who you may convince by the examples that we gave. But here, having said that, you'll notice that in the article it says first, second, third. There are three arguments that are made in the article, and they're not concerning the reality of the resurrection. They deal with why the resurrection is central and necessary to our faith. In other words, you can't be a Christian unless you accept that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And so we want to look at those verses that explain why that's so. Ron, did you have your hand up a minute ago?
Comment that God cannot exist or will not exist in space, time, continuum, anyhow. So the eternity cannot exist in a limited space, time, continuum. By definition, eternity cannot exist here. It's somewhere else.
Well, you know, this is the problem with that approach. And you'll hear, it's an interesting thing, because when you hear skeptics argue this, there are a number. Carl Sagan was an example, who now is convinced that there is a God, by the way. He's since passed from this life. But the other individual who's very well known, that he has the disease and can't speak. Thank you. Stephen Hawking. And others, when they argue, they always anthropomorphize. Did I say it correctly? God. They turn God into a man. And so what they do is they limit God. They say, God can't exist because, and then they'll make a reference to some physical argument. God can't exist because, and then they'll make reference to some perceived imperfection in His character, or something that they perceive to be illogical with regard to the revelation concerning God that is found in the Bible or in some other religious document. He can't exist because, and they use these logical arguments and these scientific arguments and these different kinds of reasoning, and what they're doing is putting God within the construct of space-time. Construct of this physical universe, and instead of understanding that that He supersedes and is beyond those types of limitations, and as a being exists separate from that, and as such we cannot using human reasoning explain Him away. We can't using human reasoning explain Him at all, and that's a mistake that that these naturalists make, but of course they do so because they approach it from naturalism, from what can be observed in the physical universe. And again, you know, it's interesting that the faith of a child can simply accept and reason and acknowledge the existence of the Almighty God. And the more you strive to explain it and to quantify it and establish how, you become limited because you're trying to use human wisdom to establish and to prove those things. And you know that's not the way it works. So we accept the supernatural by faith. But what we want to do is, having established those things, look at again in the material that we have here in the lesson, some of the reasons why it's so important that we accept the concept of the resurrection. Okay, anybody want to add anything before we get into those three arguments? All right, let us then begin with the first argument, and that is that Jesus predicted his resurrection. So, in other words, if you deny the resurrection, then you're calling Jesus a liar, because Jesus predicted his own resurrection from the dead. In John chapter 10, in verses 17 and 18, Jesus indicated that he had the power to lay down his life and the power to take it up again. There is that direct allusion to his resurrection in John chapter 2. It's one among several that have been given, where he said he would destroy the temple in 3 days. And he had reference to the temple of his body, as indicated in the text. And as Mark read it earlier, in verse 22 of the text, when the disciples witnessed the resurrected Christ, then they remembered what it is that he had said in glory in his fulfilled prophecy. So this is a prophecy or prediction that Jesus made concerning himself. You'll notice in the text of the article a reference to Deuteronomy, the 18th chapter in verse 22. There were individuals who were false prophets in those days, and there was a test that could be used to determine whether a prophet was a true prophet or a false prophet. It's a very simple test. It's the one that Harold Camper or whatever his name was, the individual who claimed that the world was coming to an end last October or whenever it was, May, I think, first in October and May, whenever it was. But he claimed the world was going to come to an end. How do you know that he was a false prophet? The world didn't come to an end. And that's what Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 22 says. That's how you'll know whether a prophet is prophesying on his own or whether what he received is from God, is whether it comes true or not. If an individual prophesies, that's the reason the Jehovah's Witnesses, I can't believe anybody would follow after them, because they kept coming up with different dates. For 1898 was the first, 1914 was the second. They tried it again in the 1930s, I believe, in the 40s, and up into the 70s. And then when nothing happened in all of those times, then they went back to 1918 and said he came, but he just came in an invisible fashion, so we didn't see him. But they kept making these predictions concerning the fact that Jesus would come, the world would come to an end, and it never happened. False prophets. It's a very simple way of determining that. So Jesus, if he predicted that he would be raised from the third day from the dead, and he wasn't, then he was a false prophet. You do not want to be a follower of someone who is a false prophet. That's an indication that what they say is of themselves. It is not of God. Am I right in saying, because I forget, I believe though, David Koresh, and during the Waco siege with the cult following that he had there in Waco, that he made the claim as well that he would be resurrected from the dead. If I remember correctly, that claim was made. David Koresh is dead. He was not resurrected. He's a false prophet. Now we had evidence that he was a false prophet before then because of other things that he taught and claimed. But that's an indication. That's proof. Said he would be raised. He wasn't raised. If Jesus wasn't raised, he's a false prophet. Justin.
Yeah, logical flaw in your argument. You said you couldn't imagine why anyone followed the Jehovah's Witnesses because they're false, and then you said you couldn't imagine the reason Paul would follow Jesus other than that he was true.
Okay, what's the... I sometimes struggle with my logic, so what's the fallacy there?
Because... Jesus could have been Paul, and Paul could have followed him for reasons beyond your imagination, doesn't it?
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's say my personal observation is that I have a hard time understanding why people follow Jehovah's Witnesses because they have been shown to be false prophets time and again. The reason why the Apostle Paul did follow Jesus is because he's an eyewitness to the truthfulness of his claims. Is that good enough? Or did I repeat the same fallacy? Okay, modify a little bit. Anyway, all right, then as we continue on, the second point that is made here concerns the fact that Jesus as king, sitting upon the throne of David, that in order for him to reign on the throne of David, as he understood it and as he proclaimed it, required the bodily resurrection and ascension into heaven. Jesus did not sit upon David's throne while on earth. In fact, the premillennialists, as they misunderstand this entire concept, claim that he was thwarted in his attempt to reign on the throne of David, and as such it will necessitate a coming for him to reign on the physical throne, not understanding the theology of what Jesus intended in that. There are a number of verses that are mentioned in this, and one that is mentioned is actually stated incorrectly. You'll notice it states concerning the establishment of his kingdom, the church was predicated upon him breaking through the prison bars of Hades, Matthew 16:16. The reference there is to Matthew 16:18, if you want to make that change, where Jesus proclaimed that the gates of hell or Hades shall not prevail against the church. And the argument that he makes here is the church and the kingdom are one and the same, which is something that we have argued quite often. The establishment of the church, establishment of the kingdom, is one and the same. Different images referring to Jesus with regard to the church, or the called out, the body, having reference to the people. With regard to the kingdom, having reference to his reign and authority, but that they were established on the day of Pentecost, and that was accomplished through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. But looking at those verses, there are references in Acts 2, verse 24, and also 2 verses 31 through 33, to the fact that God had raised him up, having loosed the pains of death, and the affirmation that the Apostle Paul makes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 15, that Jesus Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And in verse 16 of that text indicates in that argument that he alone has immortality, and ties in his kingship, his reigning on the throne, to be that throne in heaven that is tied up with his resurrection from the dead and his immortality, the fact that he's alive and will never die. So there is the second argument that is made. Anybody want to add anything to that? Okay, now I'd like to get through to the third, since we've got 5 minutes, and just get through them. If Roger wants to touch upon it any more than that, we can certainly do so. But the third is Jesus. Is that the second one? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, I can't do that then. All right. Then have Roger start with the third point, and I'll tell him that third point in the article, and then you can get into the questions. I thought I had 5 more minutes. Sorry about that.